Everyone here this evening. It's good to see a good turnout, especially when we're getting into the dog days of summer. This was announced by Albert that we are looking at the subject of a family for the Lord. Right. Here we go. All right. I think it's one of those times that everything's going to go wrong. Nancy let me know that my voice was fading this morning every time I turned that way. So I'm just going to stand right here, endure the heat, and just read this thing to you as loud as voice as possible, you know, so we can get through this thing. And I may go back there every once in a while to show you something. But we are looking at the subject of a family for the Lord from Ephesians 3. And as you're looking at this particular slide, and the verse that's portrayed there, Ephesians 3, sometimes people get the wrong impression. You know, like you use the example of God being king. People often think that, well, God calling himself a king is sort of to identify himself with earthly kings, so we kind of know a function of him. But the truth is, he was a king before there ever was a king on earth. And same with Father. He didn't take a title that men came up with in order to kind of identify with us. Before there were families, God was a Father in heaven. And so if we're going to look at families, the quintessential family we can look at, and what we should keep in uppermost in our mind is that when we're looking at our own families, to model them in a perfect paradigm is to look to God and see what kind of a father he was to his son, or as a family situation, what sort of relationship Jesus had with the church. Those will give us, you know, the perfect examples, because a lot of times what we have in the world are imperfect examples, dysfunctional families, and sometimes we take our models from those and then wonder why everything's going wrong. As we get into the word family has a beautiful sound and brings joy to the heart. However, some of this joy dissipates when we recognize that so many families are filled with heartaches, hatred, tears. And as you look at the various kinds of family, what makes the difference? It's not because the concept of family breaks down, but because many fail to apply God's concept of family to what's going there. God has laid down principles to help the family and to make it a happy one. When these principles are ignored, homes fail. However, when these God-given principles are followed, the product is a family for the Lord. And so this is what we have to keep in mind. I know a lot of people go, well, I'm going to get married. You know, we'll get married and live happily ever after. It's not a done deal. I mean, it's not a given. What you've done is enter into a project, really. Well, you're saying, I want to get into a situation where I want to work it a certain way. I want to give as much as possible as an investment into making it come out, as a spouse, you know, and as a parent. You can't just think, well, I'm just going to have kids. Really, what are you going to do with them? They're not like pets where you just put them in a bowl and feed them every once in a while or take them for a walk. There's a lot that has to go into it. There's an engineering process. There's things that have to be done. There's an overall plan to follow that's God-given. And so what we're going to do is look at some of this, at least three elements that need to be considered in building a family. Okay? The first is there must be good influence. Before a family can be labeled a family for the Lord, both parents must recognize the power of influence and how, through influence, a family either goes right or wrong. Okay? The spouse is going to pick up on how you deal with things. A lot of times it's going to be reactionary. You know, if you've got a bad attitude or whatever coming into or lash out, they're going to copy that manner in order to protect themselves. The children in the same way. Most parents can see how they influence their children from week to week. Paul was teaching this principle when he wrote the following passage, Romans 14:7, for not one of us lives for himself, not one of us dies for himself. That is, as we're here in this life, we are an influence, or should think of ourselves as an influence. And we have to be a good influence for all those around us. You know, for our neighbors, for people we work with, those that, you know, our fellow students, but especially in the home. You know, how are we influencing it for good? Point three here is that, therefore, if you desire to have a family for the Lord, you should ask, how faithful do I want my children to be to church? I mean, one of the biggest, you know, moans I hear is people later in life when they say, well, the kids don't want to come to church anymore. If they're still under your roof, it doesn't matter what they want to begin with. If they said, well, I don't want to go to school anymore, are you going to let them? It's more important that they go to church than they go to school. Okay, as long as you've got the job of raising them and rearing them with the best possible person, church is where they ought to be. How much interest do I want them to have in Christianity when they grow up? Have we set an example for them, or get a proper influence for them in their younger lives? The answers to these questions will be determined by your influence now. How faithful are you as parents to the Lord and His church? How much are you letting God influence you? Even as you have to be an influence to your children, your children have to allow an influence. So it's a two-way street, or your spouse has to allow an influence. 1 Corinthians 15:58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain. So you're going to have to put out there to be a good influence, but God's going to recompense you for it. Okay, so don't shirk the labor. One quotation found, influence never dies. Every act, every motion, every look, every word makes influence tell for good or evil. This is why you have to be careful of whatever comes out of your mouth, even when it bangs around in your head, because it's going to come out one way or other, and it's going to influence people around you one way or the other. It'll also be an effective for happiness or woe through the long future of eternity. The life of a faithful Christian is basically a guide to paradise. Jesus came to be an influence for us and a guide to get us to heaven. The way we structure our own lives, pattern it after Him, will make us a guide for others to reach the same destination. With this also, there must be true worship. That's got to be part of the family. A family for the Lord is concerned about worship. This is our link with God. You know, as we worship in assembly, and we'll get to that in a moment, this is where we come to, in essence, communicate as a family, to offer praise, you know, to remember the sacrifice of the Son. Okay, a lot of it's just incorporated in the assembly, but that's got to be brought over into the family as well. A family for the Lord is concerned about worship. This is our link with God in a world given over to sin. I mean, this is where you come to get the upward influence. Okay, the more you stay in the world and not come around God, the more the world is going to be the influence. Those that leave worship to God out of their lives cannot have a family for God. Now, in this, there are two very important places for family worship. One of them is in the home. Although it is natural to think about public assembly when one thinks about worship, it is vitally important, true, but the true worship or the true foundation for worship is in the home. Before there was a church, before there was a synagogue, before there was a temple, it was in the home. The head of every family was the direct communication with God. And just because we came up with a synagogue and a church or whatever doesn't mean that the family becomes dysfunctional in this area. When the Lord blesses our home with little ones, we have a responsibility to keep God always before them. Now, what you're trying to do is, in this world, you're trying to build a place of sanctuary. A place where people, a spouse or a child or whatever, can come and feel safe, secure, loved. Because they're not going to get that in the world. This was kind of brought home to me one time when, let's see, was it a starting junior high? And up until that, you're in elementary school, and if you ever went anywhere, your parents took you and all that kind of stuff, and it wasn't a big shame at that time. But when you start junior high, the parents can't come with you. I mean, it's like the ultimate disgrace. Okay, so you're turned loose in a place that you're not familiar with, and you've got to work your way around through a system that you don't know, and you've got to get into classes, and half the time they're, you know, shut down or whatever, and you have to settle for something else. At least that's the way when I went. And by the end of the day, I was tired, worn out, had to walk 3 miles back to home, and I was looking forward to getting there, and oh man, just to get in familiar surroundings, you know, a cool room, settle down, maybe flop into bed. And when I got there, I found out my mom had rearranged my room, so nothing was familiar. Man, I just wanted to cry. You're looking forward to a place that everything was, you know, familiar, you know, loving, whatever, and you know, that should be home. So can you imagine, you know, if that's the only place you can go to get away from the strain of the world, what do we do when we run an abusive home? We've taken away the last sense of security for a spouse, perhaps that's had a long, hard day. Or a child, perhaps the bully has chased them home from the playground. You know, they have nowhere to go. Now we've made a very insecure person. The child learns to know God and to worship Him by observing his parents. Those that pretend to know God for the sake of their children will be shocked to learn that their children can see right through it. They know what the truth is. They know when you're faking it. And so that's what they learn, to fake it. Just as true love and adoration for God cannot be hidden, neither can the rule of a hypocrite. The father that sends his children to worship with the hope that they will learn to love, to truly love God, even though he himself has no interest, is deceived. I mean, the parent is the one that the child first looks up to. Okay, that's the role model to begin with. And so very young, that's where they're going to learn. You know, Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. Okay, what have you done for the first formidable years of his life? You've trained him not to like services. And that's going to stay with him for the rest of his life. Unless he figures it out. It is wonder just how many parents are consciously rearing their children for the Lord. The Old Testament tells of Hannah. Okay, I mean, this lady, she sincerely wanted a child, and she promised God, you know, if he would give her a child, she would raise him up in the Lord. Now, when you're really dedicated to that purpose, okay, the Lord knows it. He gave her, he blessed her with a child. She weaned him, raised him for the first, you know, years of his life. But she made sure he also, you know, got turned over to God at a very young age. And what was the result? Well, we've studied Samuel. It's hard to find anyone superior to this individual in his dedication to his fellow man and his God. I mean, he's got so many distinctions. Here is the last of the judges. You know, when the judges are beginning to fail, he's the very last bastion of justice being done in Israel. Okay? He's, as a statesman, he's working hard and he's going to all the tribes in order to keep them together in hard times, even when they're being overrun by Philistines. Okay? He is so dedicated to God, he's keeping the temple worship. You know, he's preserving it, and he's setting up a school for prophets So he's named as the beginning of the prophets. This is what a child can turn into when his parent has dedicated him to God. The influence is overpowering. Okay, we went through that. The other place is what we've talked about, in the place of worship. Once the foundation has been laid at the home, it will be easier to teach them how to honor God at assembly. Like, worship at assembly begins at home. Parents should not wait until service begins to prepare for worship. As the day of worship gets closer, our children should be reminded of the importance of the occasion. When the child comes, I can talk about my own background. My parents made sure that I had my lesson done for Sunday school. That there's such a lack of interest, I've seen that sometimes here, but in other congregations, where there's no responsibility. The teacher has to keep the assignment books because they know the child won't bring it back next week. Or if he does come, he hasn't done anything in it. Or he forgets it. Yeah. What were the parents doing? I mean, Saturday night they should have been going, do you have your lesson done? Have you got it all prepared? Okay. We're going to services tomorrow. Be up early and get ready. I've known of parents that let their children go out and stay till 1:30 in the morning on a Saturday night. That's really preparing them for Sunday. That kid's useless. I mean, when he comes to services, all he wants to do is sleep. What are you thinking about? Okay. Or even yourself. Are you preparing yourself to come to services? As the day of worship gets closer, the children should be reminded of the importance of the occasion. Here again, our attitude at home is carried into the public assembly. If our children are made to feel that we do not want to go, and if we criticize the church and all related to it, they will be difficult to control. I remember a preacher talking about something that kind of hit home every once in a while. He said, okay, you've come to services, and now you're headed home. And the parents in the front seat are bad-mouthing either somebody in the congregation or how bad the preacher was or how bad the teaching was, whatever, and how they didn't like it, and it's such a bother and everything else. And you got these two little big ears in the back seat sucking it all in. Their attitude is being transferred to that child. And they wonder why the kid doesn't like to go to services. In John 4:24, the familiar passage, God's a spirit, and those who worship, they have to worship in spirit and in truth. Are you being true about your worship? It's not just a matter of, are we doing it according to the scriptures? Are you doing it from the heart sincerely? Many of our children are lost to the church mainly because they are never taught the proper respect for worship. In the words of Carlyle, what greater calamity can fall upon a nation than the loss of worship? If you read some of the things of the founding fathers, even Jefferson and Franklin basically were worried about losing religion in the nation, because they knew that morals and religion were the foundation of the nation. And that comes from having families, that were taught the Bible and having it taught in schools. The family is vitally important for all sorts of things, but especially for the nation. If the family begins to break down, and in fact, one English anthropologist traced the destruction of 80 civilizations beginning with the breakdown of the family. A family is a place where people congregate to love one another, where selfishness is put aside. You cannot have a family and be selfish. a very selfish person doesn't get married to begin with, doesn't care for a spouse, you know, lives on a level that's very shallow, doesn't make any kind of commitments. Okay? It doesn't even conceive of getting with a person and being with them through the rest of life as a partner to share problems with, to share joys with, to discuss how to work things out between themselves, you know, the children, whatever problems they encounter on the outside. Doesn't even get, you know, they just, you know, they don't want to get involved, they don't want to hassle, whatever. Very selfish. If you have that kind of individual, this is not an individual that will join the military to fight for his country. This is not an individual that gets, you know, becomes a part of a community to preserve it. This is an individual who could care less if a country, you know, succeeds or fails. But when you have someone caught up in a family, these are the individuals that care about that family. They care about other individuals than themselves. Therefore, they care about the community they're in, the schools they go to, the people that they elect as politicians, the dangers on their borders. This is what preserves a country, that small unit of the family. Even Plato in his Republic argued for the preservation of the family for the good of the Greek democracy. It's Carlisle. No, here's what I wanted to come up here. How do you feel about assembly? Leviticus 23:36. On the eighth day, God said, you shall have a, look at that interesting word, holy convocation. We've talked about that, you know, before, as opposed to a congregation. We call ourselves a congregation. And Trench says congregating is what cows do around a water hole. What the church is a convocation. That is an assembly of individuals with a purpose. This is what the synagogue was, what the temple gathering was. This is what the church should be. A holy, special, set aside time from special from everything else in the world of a get together of individuals, and they should present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. But it's a holy convocation. And that's a term that should stick in our minds. That's what the church is, a holy convocation. Notice, and we come in the presence of God, Zechariah 2:13, be silent, all flesh before the Lord, for he is aroused from his holy habitation. It's nice that we're friendly, and we should be friendly to visitors that come and everything else. But when it gets time for worship, we should be settling down. I mean, one of the things I got to get to the denominations, when you walk into a Catholic church or whatever, you know, it's quiet. There's a respect for God as you walk into it. If we can blend the two, where we can be friendly with one another and visitors, but also have that respectful silence as we begin to engage in worship. It should be there. We are in the presence of God, and that should be awesome to us. Finally, there must be some true love. Love is a beautiful wrapping that encloses all the virtues in a family. Since God himself is love, 1 John 4:8, how could a family be designated a family for the Lord without this vital element? When we as parents show love for our children, we also teach and enforce the characteristics of love. We show them what it is because it's a hard concept. It's an abstract at first until we make it tangible for them. What are some of the things that we teach our children when we teach them love? Well, we teach them that love, you know, is sharing. Love teaches the balance between the importance of self and sharing that self with others. If children are to mature, they need to learn to be less possessive. I mean, isn't that the sign of a childish, you know, intellect when it wants everything? You know, it's its toy, it won't share it with its friends in the sandbox. Well, it comes to the world needing, and it gets everything it demands. You know, the child cries, screams, whatever, and it's got adults that, you know, just hover around it, you know, trying to change its diapers or feed it or whatever, you know, to get it to shut up. I mean, it trains us to begin with, and it's really the most selfish thing on this planet. Somewhere along the line, the job of the parent is to teach that child he's not the soul of the universe, that he has to share this planet with others of equal importance. And as he matures, the true sign of maturity is learning to put yourself out for others and to be there as a help for others. Notice, let's see what we have here. What Zacharias learned. As he approaches the Lord, he goes, listen, I'm a tax collector, but, you know, half of what I have, I will give to the poor. And if I have wronged anyone, I will pay back four times. Just show me. You know, I'm that willing. Okay, this is clicking over into a maturity that the Spirit brings. John 15:13, Jesus said, greater love has no one than this. You know, what's the greatest love? To give yourself, to give up your life for another. Love has good manners. It's impossible for it not to have good manners. Love provides the proper environment for all other great attributes of life to grow and to bear fruit. Good manners are nothing more than a consideration for others. If children are taught not to envy, not to boast, not to be full of pride, not to be rude, not or self-seeking or easily angered, they will instinctively have good manners. You don't have to send them to a finishing school. You know, their character will be such, you know, you can take them anywhere because they're considerate of other people and their things. So they'll be well-behaved and well-mannered. They'll instinctively say yes, sir, yes, ma'am to an adult. They won't talk back. A lady told me one time, you know, she trains, you know, people to sell their houses. And she said one of the things she did when she was managing an apartment complex, and, you know, a mother and child would come in, you know, to rent an apartment. She said the first thing she'd do is give a sucker to the child. Now, if the mother told the child to put the sucker away for later, she was more prone to rent the apartment to the person. If the lady let the child take the wrapper off, throw it on the floor, stick it in its mouth, get it all gooey, and then start, you know, painting the walls and everything else with it, chances are she wasn't going to rent that apartment to her, because she knew they wouldn't respect it. Good manners pays. Really does. Notice, Romans 13:10, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. Never does anything wrong to a neighbor. Or 1 Timothy 3:15, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct themselves in the household of God, Church of the Living God. Christianity is about proper conduct. It's about good manners. Love is unselfish. For some reason, children will often show less selfishness outside the family than in it. Therefore, do not be too disappointed if at times we feel that love has failed with our children. This is important as a parent to understand. In fact, it was brought home just last week. I caught something on Dr. Phil. You know, they had a family there, and he was trying to settle a problem between this teenage daughter and a stepfather. And the way the situation was going, you know, she was rude, she was belligerent, she was rebellious, you know, they just weren't getting along at all. But the interesting thing about it was, when you interviewed everybody outside the home about the girl, whether the church group or friends or teachers or whatever, all of them said, she's, you know, a decent, nice, sweet girl, studies hard, gets straight A's, you know, is kind to everybody. She's a totally different person, like Jekyll and Hyde. Sometimes we put undue pressures on in the family and wonder why our kids are such rotten little monsters, not realizing that actually we've had a good influence on them, but the influence is shown to everybody else but us. So sometimes we gotta kind of wait for things to kind of settle down. You know, love will have its effect. If you've done it right and something starts to go wrong in teenage times, you know, we just kind of got to get through it together. But notice, love is a positive virtue and it stays alive and strong even when buried among childish ways. This verse, Philippians 2:3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but humility of mind, let each regard one another as more important than himself. This is a powerful verse. This is what our founding fathers based our government on. Primarily this verse. This is the way small government works. When you can get every citizen looking out for everyone else but themselves, do you know how much money you're going to save in police forces and court costs? How smoothly things begin to go. I mean, you may read over it and go, well, you know, the platitudes, you know, idealistic stuff, whatever. No, these are hard principles that work in the most extreme situations. They build nations. They preserve families. You know, they build up neighborhoods and communities. This is a viable principle. And when it's backed up by a good fear and love of God, you got something beautiful that works for a long time. And it's not just idealistic, it's realistic. It works. People let it. Okay, then we go into little story at the end. A man once parked his car on the street. You can read the story. I want to do something else here. We got a closing song of 245. Let me make this the invitation. 245, which, you know, Albert has chosen as, you know, the closing song for this. You know, invitation to get you to. But I want to concentrate on something, you know, that's even more along with what we're talking about. The song to follow that. 626. Is that what it is? You know, peace like a river. Now, we've been through this before, but we got some new faces. Sometimes the more you understand about what goes behind the song, a greater appreciation you have for the song. There's several things about peace like a river that you need to know. First of all, the man who wrote it, he had lost everything he owns in the Great Chicago Fire. Having nothing, and this gets you appreciation of family. He sent his wife and I think two of the children, sending them back to Europe to be with family there until he got things on his feet. On the voyage over there, the ship sank. So not only did he lose everything, he lost half the family. When he finally got the other child and was himself, you know, on another boat heading over, the captain came to him and told him exact place where the family went down. He walked over to the rail to look at the spot, and the whole of this song just kind of came to him. It's where he found the courage to go on. Yeah. If that doesn't tug at your heartstrings... The other thing, the guy that arranged the music. Yeah, he and his wife were coming back from some sort of a religious get-together, and they were on a train. And just as they were crossing a trellis, you know, it broke down, and the train went over the trellis into the water beneath. As he was looking for his wife, he found her trapped under some wreckage, and he couldn't get it off of her. He chose to stay with her. Strength of family. You know, we really don't realize how precious it is until we start losing, you know, parts or all of it. I mean, even though you're not our family and it happened a long time ago, still, even as you talk about it, you know, it's hard to think about it. And I dare you to sing the song right now without choking up. So that's part of the invitation then. Yeah, of realizing what a precious thing God has given us and to really work to maintain the preciousness of it. Yeah, to build it strong on love and all the other elements that need to go into it. Yeah, and if there's any way we can help you with that, yeah, please let us know as we stand to sing.